After the Apostle Paul was shipwrecked on the island of Malta, he healed a man with a fever, and the news of that spread.
People with all kinds of diseases came in to Paul, and Paul laid his hands on them, and they were healed. So we see that even while he's a prisoner, and his missionary journeys, so to speak, are over, Paul is still being used of Christ in the ministry of the apostolic faith.
Welcome to the Lord's Day edition of Renewing Your Mind. I'm Lee Webb, and we continue Dr. R.C. Sproul's sermon series from the Book of Acts. We've been following Paul's missionary journeys, learning about his perseverance. He was met with persecution and violence nearly everywhere he went. In our most recent studies, he was arrested and put on trial before consuls and kings. At one of those trials, Paul appealed to Caesar, and that's where we pick up the story today as Paul makes his way to Rome. At every phase of his journey, we see Paul's faithfulness to God. Last week, we heard about that incredible storm that led to Paul being shipwrecked, the wind driving them along for 14 days, and all hope of being saved was lost among the sailors. But Paul assured them of their safety. Let's continue the study now with Dr. Sproul.
Chapter 27 ended by telling what happened after the ship floundered that was carrying the 276 passengers, and how when the ship broke up, those who could swim made it to shore on their own. Those who could not swim held on to pieces of wood from the broken ship, and they were washed up on shore. And exactly as Paul had prophesied in their midst, not a single person on board the ship lost his life, but they all reached the beach alive. But they reached that beach exhausted, cold, and wet. Remember, it's now November, and it's a very cold time of the year on Malta. Now, the local natives that the Greeks here call barbarians, only because they considered anybody who wasn't Greek or wasn't Jewish to be barbarian, indicated that they hardly act like vicious barbarians, but instead were extremely hospitable towards these people who had been shipwrecked. And they dragged them out of the water, brought them safely to shore, and they built a bonfire to give warmth to those who were standing around shivering, wet, and also to cook food to feed them in their hunger. And the text tells us that as Paul's normal behavior was, he just didn't stand around and watch what was happening. He participated in this ministry of mercy, went out and gathered some twigs for the fire and added them to the fire. And when that happened, an extraordinary event took place. Suddenly, a viper that apparently had been torpid due to the cold weather, as snakes will be. It's not safe to go into the woods looking for golf ball men during the summer in Central Florida. But when you get in December and January, you can usually tromp around among the palmettos without fear of rattlesnakes because they're either asleep or very torpid indeed. But in any case, the warmth of the fire revived this viper. And as Paul was placing the twigs on the fire, this viper struck him and clung to his hand. Now, that incident that is described here has been the target of certain critics throughout church history. One criticism is this, that there are no poisonous snakes, no snakes at all, on the island of Malta. Just like there aren't in Ireland, but there used to be. And even though we have no record of St. Patrick ever visiting Malta, we do have abundant records from antiquity testifying that at that time there were poisonous snakes there. But after the island was completely populated, the snakes disappeared as they lost their natural habitat. That happens. The other complaint is, they say, if this is a viper, the viper doesn't strike and hold on to its victim, But it strikes suddenly, pulls its fangs back. And so Luke is incorrect in describing a viper biting Paul and holding on. However, there are numerous examples in nature and in history of vipers that strike, and when they strike, get their fangs caught on the clothing or boots or whatever and are not instantly removed. I know a man who was stricken by a 6-foot-long diamondback rattlesnake here in Central Florida. He fortunately was wearing boots. The good news was the boots saved him from having the fangs penetrate too deeply into his foot. The bad news was the fangs stuck in the boot, and he couldn't get rid of the snake as much as he tried to shake it loose. And so it's very possible that this snake was one who caught himself on Paul's sleeve or whatever while he was striking him. The other argument is that these natives who identified the snake as a viper didn't know what they were talking about. Now, this is from critics who look back over 2,000 years. They weren't there, and they're thousands of miles removed. They don't know anything about the ancient flora and fauna of Malta, and they doubt the word of the eyewitnesses of the account. But the reason why they struggle so much with the story is obvious. It's a miracle. And that's the way Luke records it, as the sober truth of what happened by the intervention of Almighty God. But one thing about these natives, as kind, as generous as they were also, like many of us, swift to make judgments that were incorrect. The first thing they assumed when they saw that snake on Paul's hand was this: ha! He must be a murderer. Because how else can you explain that he survives this shipwreck and now, in this quirk of events, he's bitten by a deadly snake? This they attributed to Nemesis, who was the mythological god for vengeance. And that's where the word comes over into our language. Somebody that's constantly giving us a hard time and making our lives miserable, we say that person is our nemesis. Well, they attributed this work to Nemesis, whose job it was to bring justice to people where other attempts to bring justice had failed. And so that was their first assumption. And so they prepared for Paul's imminent demise. They watched him, waiting for him to swell up and to drop over dead. But he didn't swell, and he didn't die. And so now they realized that they had made a mistake. Paul wasn't a murderer at all. He was a god. They were wrong in the second count. First, they thought he was a murderer, then they thought he was a god, and Paul was neither a murderer nor a god. Rather, he was an apostle of Jesus Christ, fulfilling the mission that Christ had given to him. And it calls to mind the long ending of the gospel according to St. Mark, where we read in Mark chapter 16, verse 15, the words of Jesus with respect to the Great Commission. Here's what he said: "Go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. He who believes and is baptized will be saved, but he who does not believe will be condemned. And these signs will follow those who believe. In my name they will cast out demons, they will speak with new tongues, they will take up serpents, and if they drink anything deadly, it will by no means hurt them. They will lay hands on the sick, and they will recover." And virtually every one of these signs that Jesus said that would accompany the apostolic mission in the spreading of the gospel literally took place in the life and mission of the Apostle Paul. By the way, that's the text that the snake handlers use as their proof text for their religion, where they like to play with the rattlesnakes and so on. Paul wasn't playing with snakes that day, by the way, just in case you're inclined towards snake handling. But anyway, we read that in that region there was an estate of the leading citizen of the island whose name was Publius. Luke said he received us and entertained us courteously for 3 days. And now it happened that the father of Publius lay sick of a fever and dysentery. We know what that disease was. It was a recurring illness called the bacteria Malta disease, caused by the bacteria that was common to the goats that were there on the island. And Luke correctly diagnosed the problem that the man had, and in some respects it was like malaria, in that there would be an acute phase when a person would be desperately ill from this disease, this Maltese fever as it was called, and then they would recover, and then maybe 6 months later or a year later, there would be a recurrence of it, and then again in another 6 months, and through a person's entire life, they would be plagued by reoccurrences of Maltese fever from the goat milk. Well, Luke diagnosed it. Paul cured it. Paul came to the father of Publius. He laid his hands on him and cured him of this dreadful disease. And when the word of that spread around the countryside, people with all kinds of diseases came in to Paul, and Paul laid his hands on them, and they were healed. So we see that even while he's a prisoner, and his missionary journey, so to speak, are over, Paul is still being used of Christ in the ministry of the apostolic faith. Then what follows from this is a description of the rest of the voyage, and I'd like to spend a few moments on that. Verse 11 says, after 3 months we sailed in an Alexandrian ship, another Alexandrian ship, previous, like the one that wrecked, and it was probably a grain ship, part of that fleet, and it said whose figurehead was the twin brothers. Now Luke tells us the name of the ship. And they would take their name from the decoration or adornment that was carved into the prow of the ship. And this particular ship had in its prow the decorative carving of the twins. What twins? Not the Minnesota twins. These twins were the mythical twins, Caspar and Pollux, who had their correspondence in the sky in the constellation that is called Gemini. Now, of course, nobody in this day and age believes that the constellation Gemini has any influence over the lives of people. Only those who ask each other, what's your sign? And only those who look every day at the horoscope to see what kind of a day fate has prescribed for them. But ancient mariners believed that that particular constellation of Gemini had particular jurisdiction over the sea and over mariners. Much like in our own day, the patron saint of sailors is Saint Elmo. You hear of St. Elmo's fire. Well, in any case, Paul gets on board this Alexandrian ship named after the twins from the Gemini, and all the good luck and good fortune blessing upon this ship, and it sets sail for Italy. And we read here in the text, and landing at Syracuse, which was the major city of Sicily. Landing at Syracuse, we stayed for 3 days. From there, we circled round and reached Rhegium. Now, Rhegium is on the toe of the boot of Italy. So they sail from Sicily, from Syracuse, to Rhegium. Now, in order to make that journey by the sea, they have to pass through the Strait of Messina. And the Strait of Messina was a very narrow passageway and was famous at that time for the treacherous waters that were there in that narrow passage. In fact, the treacherousness of that portion of the sea has been immortalized for all time in Greek literature and on into English history through the immortal work of Homer. You remember Homer wrote the Iliad and the Odyssey. The Iliad was about the Trojan War and how all of these great heroes entered into combat with each other. And the second volume is after the Trojan War is over. Homer gives us the perilous journey of Odysseus, or called normally Ulysses, back home to Sicily. Remember that? If some of you old-timers remember the Hollywood movie with Kirk Douglas, who takes on the Cyclops and the Sirens and the Furies and the Fates and all of that business. Well, if you recall Homer's story of the Odyssey, Odysseus has to sail his ship through the Strait of Messina. And he has to sail between, and see if you remember this, not from your literature, between Scylla and Charybdis. Have you ever heard that expression? Certainly you've read it on more than one occasion. Anytime a person has a dangerous voyage to take or a difficult decision to make and there's no easy solution, the simplified version is we say we're between a rock and a hard place. For the ancient people would say we're between Scylla and Charybdis. Scylla was this mythological monster dog who lived in a cave by the shore of the Straits of Messina. And the mythology went like this. If a ship unawares sailed too close to that shore, then Scylla would jump out of the cave and reach out and snatch one or two sailors from the ship, take them back into his cave, and devour them. On the other hand, Charybdis was not an animal or a monster. Charybdis was a whirlpool. And the whirlpool appeared three times every day. And it was a violent whirlpool that if a ship sailed near that whirlpool, got caught up in the eddy, it would then be taken down to the bottom of the sea, losing the ship and all hands. So if you remember the story of the Odyssey, Odysseus or Ulysses was very careful when he sailed through that strait to favor the side of Scylla rather than Charybdis, because the worst that could happen on the Scylla side was he might lose one or two sailors. But if he gets too close to Charybdis, all hands go to the bottom of the sea. But this wasn't Ulysses. This wasn't Odysseus. And there really wasn't any Scylla. That's silly. And there really wasn't any Charybdis. Just treacherous sea. And on this occasion, between the two shores, the ship that was carrying the cargo of Paul the Apostle. Moving from Sicily to the toe of the boot and then sailing again from Rhegium, further on up the Italian coast that brought him to Puteoli, which was on the coast of Italy. And there they found, Luke says, brethren, and were invited to stay with them for 7 days, and so we went toward Rome. Let's just stop for a minute. Finally, after all of these hardships, the ship bearing Paul from Jerusalem, Caesarea, finally arrives in Italy. They are on dry ground now, and the rest of the trip will be on land. And Paul is finally in Italy, and when he arrives in Italy, he's greeted by Christians because the gospel had already been published there in Rome. And Paul had written to the Roman Christians 3 years earlier, but he had never yet been there. But you remember in the first chapter of Paul's letter to the Romans, he made this poignant statement. He said, I make mention of you always in my prayers, directing this to the Romans, making request if by some means, now at last, I may find a way in the will of God to come to you, for I long to see you, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift so that you may be established. Do you hear the passion coming through the pen of the apostle when he writes to the Christian community that's already established in Rome? Listen to it again. He's praying that if by some means, whether it by shipwreck whether it's in chains, whether it's by fire, I don't care. If just by some means, at last, I may find a way in the will of God to meet you face to face. And now, by the invisible hand of providence, the means had been found, the way had been given. At long last, in the will of God, for his apostle to go to Rome. So after staying a few days on the coast, they began the overland journey to the eternal city. And we're told that on the way, they got as far as the Appian Forum and then the Three Taverns, if you will. And you know the story of Rome. That Rome was founded in the same year that Isaiah saw the Lord high and lifted up. And that the Roman Empire lasted for over 1,000 years. And Rome, the eternal city, was basically the central city of the world for over a millennium. And even to this day, when you go to Rome and you see the structures that remain from the early days of the empire, when you see the Circus Maximus, when you see the Colosseum, when you see the ruins of the temples, when you see the ruins of the Forum, when you see the Mamertine prison where Paul spent his last hours, all of that is still there. In fact, one of the most fascinating experiences I've ever had in my life, certainly the most memorable lunch I've ever had, was an outdoor lunch that we had on the Appian Way, right near where these taverns are that Luke mentions here in this book. Now, obviously, it wasn't the place where Paul ate on the way. That place isn't still there. But to think of the history as we were sitting there right alongside the Appian Way. And that was Paul's experience. As he, at long last, he came to his destination. And you know how he got to his destination? We've talked about the ships. We've talked about the travels. We've talked about the beatings. We've talked about all of these things. Ladies and gentlemen, he came to his destination by the sovereign providence of God. What can you learn from this? Every person in this room who is in Christ has his own or her own manifest destiny. And God is going to bring you to that destiny. We don't believe that our ultimate destiny is the hands of blind fate. But this is our Father's world, and we are His children, and He has appointed for every one of us a final terminal point. And He's the one who will bring us there. And in the midst of the storm, in the midst of the shipwreck, in the midst of the beatings, in the midst of the pain, when we want to lose courage and we want to lose hope and think that the invisible hand of God has let us go, we remember his servant Paul, who took courage when his feet landed safely on Roman soil. That's the God that we are here this morning to worship, who has each one of his people in the hollow of his hand, and he will not let you go.
Dr. R.C. Sproul held on to that promise right to the end when he went home to be with the Lord back in December. R.C. was a model of faith for us here at Ligonier Ministries. And while we miss him greatly, we are more committed than ever to continue the legacy that he left for us here at Ligonier. The sermon that you heard today was from Dr. Sproul's series in the book of Acts. Dr. Sproul urged the people of St. Andrew's Chapel, where he co-pastored for many years, to place their faith in this God who will not let his people go. Dr. Sproul wrote a series of booklets to help us understand God and his character, and one of those booklets is What Does It Mean to Be Born Again? We'd like to offer you two copies of this booklet. You can request it with your gift of any amount when you call us at 800-435-4343 or when you go online to renewingyourmind.org. And again, we'll send you two copies, one for you to read and one to share with a family member or a friend. Let me repeat our contact information. Our online address is renewingyourmind.org, and our number is 800-435-4343. Well, next week, we'll see that when Paul finally does get to Rome, things don't go quite as he expected. Join us as we return to our study in the book of Acts next Sunday here on Renewing Your Mind.